You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Murray Bookchin was an American libertarian socialist and founder of social ecology. Born on January 14, 1921, he died of heart failure July 30, 2006. During his life, he authored over two dozen books on politics, philosophy, history, and urban affairs, as well as ecology. In his obituary, his longtime companion, Janet Beale, writes, "A self-described utopian, he sought a decentralized, genuinely democratic society and placed ecology in a humanistic and social framework. At all times, he upheld reason against the alternatives and sought to bring a lived revolutionary past forward into the future." We're joined by Haya Heller to discuss Murray Bookchin's life, political achievements, and the inspiration he left for others. Haya has been an associate of the Institute for Social Ecology for 24 years. She's a writer, speaker, and activist in the feminist ecology movement. She's author of Ecology of Everyday Life, Rethinking the Desire for Nature, and she joins us now from her home in Massachusetts. Good morning, Haya.
Good morning.
Let's begin by looking at Murray's early political development. He was a member of the Communist Youth Movement at age 9,
right.
But eventually he became an anti-authoritarian. How did this transition happen?
It's actually really remarkable when you think about him and the times that he was raised in. It's true that he was born into a secular family of Jewish Russian immigrants that were very left-leaning. He joined the Communist Party. He had the self-possession to literally decide, make that decision, 9 years old, to join the party. And by the time he was 16, it was 1937, and he witnessed Stalin's Great Purge, where he literally massacred millions of people. And he literally saw, you know, and during his adolescent years, the promise of the Russian Revolution and all of its potential utopian promise just wither away into really a terrible set of atrocities and become an authoritarian nightmare. And he was extremely disenchanted by that. Yet at that point, there was really nothing else that was there to offer him. And so he remained a leftist, and you know, to the end of his life, actually. But he remained a leftist, and he remained committed to labor struggles, again, throughout his life. But he made a shift when he hit his early 40s, when the new social movements arrived. But another main turning point for him was when he was 25 years old, he worked for General Motors. He'd worked many sort of union jobs. He worked for the CIO when he was a foundry worker. He became an auto worker working for General Motors, and he was part of the big, great General Motors strike of 1946. And that strike is often associated as the moment when sort of labor sold out to capital in the U.S. and became kind of annexed, in a sense, by government and capital. And at that point was really the big turning point for him, when he really decided it's really time to look for a new approach to leftism and a new philosophy. And when the new social movements came along, or actually previous to that, during the New Left, which emerged with Students for a Democratic Society, which was called SDS, that emerged around the Civil Rights Movement and then in the anti-war movement, he saw some of the same sectarian, authoritarian tendencies reemerging in the New Left in the 60s, and he wrote one of his first widely publicized tracts called Listen Marxist, that was a pamphlet that got a tremendous amount of circulation, where he basically said, we cannot repeat the mistakes of the old left. I live to see what those mistakes turned into with, you know, culminating with Stalin. We really need a new kind of leftist orientation, and so he decided that he was going to try to build one. And so he actually looked to anarchism, which at that point was a very underdeveloped kind of framework. There was no single author anarchist who had created a philosophical framework anywhere to the degree that Marx had, for instance. It was kind of open ground, and he thought anarchism would, as basically embracing a general critique of hierarchy, would be a good place to start to build a new theory. And that is where he built the new theory of social ecology, which was an attempt to really wed left libertarian socialism that he drew from the leftist tradition with some of the insights he saw from the new social movements that included ecology.
And Murray also spent some time in the U.S. Army, didn't he?
Very, very short time. It's interesting. And in his obituaries, people have made quite a bit of that. He was drafted, and he actually ended up, ironically, guarding the gold at Fort Knox. Mostly he spent his time teaching drivers how to drive big trucks. But he was not, by any means, a military man, nor was he proud of that, or did he strongly identify with that part of his life.
His first book in 1962, Our Synthetic Environment, yes, was written under the pseudonym Lewis Herber.
Right.
What was this book about?
This book was actually interesting. It preceded by 6 months Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which is often seen as being sort of the opening of Pandora's box of ecology. And he anticipated many of the things that Carson said and predated him. And I think a lot of social ecologists wistfully feel that, in a sense, it was Murray who really was one of the first people to have these insights. Basically, in 1962, he had the forethought to recognize that we were on a collision course with the environment, that we, meaning, and I sort of use that word incorrectly, that capitalism and a hierarchically capitalist society is on an inevitable collision course with nature, that nature represents a set of finite people, places, and things, and capitalism represents an infinite consumption and kind of reprocessing of people, places, and things into commodities. And he saw, beginning in 62, what he saw is just the beginning of an enormous ecological crisis that did come to pass during his lifetime. And in fact, in 1964, just 2 years after writing Our Synthetic Environment, he was one of the first people to predict the greenhouse effect or climate change. And again, at that moment, people thought he was completely crazy. And it's important to note that at that time, leftists in particular thought that ecology was absolutely irrelevant to the political struggle. Ecology had a very dubious place within leftist thought, really until the 1980s, when some socialists decided to really start to look at ecological theory in a critical and serious way. But for a leftist to start thinking in ecological terms was a very iconoclastic and dramatic and very exciting and creative thing to do. It really had not been done before.
How did Bookchin's social ecology affect radical political movements at the time?
I mean, really, the ways in which he affected the ecology movement are limitless. First, he set up a tension between radical ecology and environmentalism. Environmentalism, before, during, and after social ecology, has really been an attempt to reform existing political and economic structures slightly in order to mitigate the negative effects on the environment. Environmentalism does not seek to radically critique the existing society or to remake it in any dramatic way. So he very much radicalized a lot of people in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond, a lot of people who were more reformist-oriented in the environmental movement. People in the anti-toxics movement became radicalized through their contact with social ecologists. Bookchin played a very key role in developing the green movement in the U.S. In 1984, he was there at the founding conference in Minneapolis with other social ecologists, and the attempt then was really to, again, wed a leftist anarchist perspective with an ecological perspective to call for a new non-hierarchical ecological society. Social ecology had a tremendous influence before that. I'm sort of skipped ahead of myself. In the 70s, on the anti-nuclear movement, Bookchin had been in Spain during the Spanish Civil War and was very inspired by the Spanish anarchists who were forming non-hierarchical confederal model, using confederal models of political organizing. And he brought that to the U.S. And through the Clamshell Alliance that kind of clustered its way through the Northeast, we saw a creation of non-hierarchical affinity groups that worked in a very mutualistic and cooperative manner that was explicitly anti-authoritarian. I think we really see the roots of contemporary anarchism forming during the anti-nuclear movement and then moving forward beyond that. But so in that way, social ecology touched contemporary reformist environmentalism. It touched the anti-nuclear movement. It touched the anti-toxics movement, where people were moving beyond just sort of the not in my backyard approach to say not on my planet. You know, we want a new society. We don't just want a town free of a particular toxin. And again, he affected the Greens. He affected the eco-feminist movement. He affected the anti-biotechnology movement that Brian Tokar, who has done a tremendous amount of work in the U.S. to popularize the struggle against biotechnology, particularly agricultural biotechnology, was very much influenced by Bookchin, who saw agricultural biotechnology as an attempt by corporations to monopolize seed production and to really disenfranchise indigenous farmers and small farmers around the world.
Bookchin also advanced the idea of post-scarcity. How does this fit into social ecology?
Post-scarcity anarchism was a book that he wrote. It came out in 1969, and it really spoke to people in the 60s, 70s, but it's still so relevant today. When I teach social ecology, I always, one of the first things I tell people is you got to go out and buy Post-Scarcity Anarchism. It's such a poetic, exuberant book. It's just such a lovely book. Basically, what he said was that, you know, for better or for worse, by the time we reach the post-war era, well into the post-war era of the 1960s, industrial capitalism had reached a means of technological sophistication sufficient to actually overcome scarcity, material scarcity in the world. For example, France, where people were still, before World War II, using farm animals to plow the land, and France had tremendous food shortages before and after World War II. France, through industrial agriculture, became an agricultural power and overcame food scarcity. And what we see now in many parts of the world, are, in the case of food, are surpluses. I want to highlight here that Bookchin in no way says that capitalism was necessary to make this happen, to facilitate this technological sophistication, nor was chemicalized or industrialized agriculture. You could have equally have had a sophisticated organic agricultural apparatus. But so for better or for worse, technological sophistication did emerge during this time that made scarcity, material scarcity in the form of lack of resources of food, shelter, etc., for the world's people, really, for the first time in world history, became something that was explicitly, let's say, human-made. So that now that when we have conditions of shortage and scarcity, we can say those conditions are actually being fabricated, really. They're not imagined. They're actually being produced by capitalist and state apparatuses that are literally impoverishing the peoples, lands, and places of cultures around the world. And what he said, what he called for with post-scarcity anarchism was an acknowledgement that A, scarcity is now being produced, and B, that we could actually create a society where we could use ecological technologies that were guided by democratic principles, directly democratic principles, and create new democratic political structures that could allow us to use our technology in such a way to have a post-scarcity society, a society where people are not struggling simply to provide for their needs, but could actually fulfill their own desires for, he talks about in that book, leisure time as being actually not just a bourgeois phenomena, but something that people could actually use to enjoy quality of life, to study, to prepare themselves to become active citizens in their worlds, to actually refine their love for art, music, politics, intellectual life, etc. So post-scarcity anarchism was part of his utopian vision that he continued to develop right until he died. It was a world in which he goes beyond Marx by saying the revolution doesn't just seek to solve the problem of scarcity. It actually seeks to go beyond that to a post-scarcity situation where people actually don't just sustain or survive, but they actually flourish. And that the fact that we are not flourishing today is the result of greed, hoarding, corruption, and social hierarchy. And it's one of its most malignant forms.
In 1971, Bookchin co-founded the Institute for Social Ecology in Plainfield, Vermont. Can you talk about the goals and aims of the Institute?
Yeah, it's actually very interesting. It actually was the idea for the Institute came from Dan Chodorkov, who was a student of Murray Bookchin's. He was a student at Goddard College, and he actually convinced Murray to create the Institute for Social Ecology. It's little known that Murray's actually was a very modest man who in no way ever dreamed of having an institute to promote his ideas. Dan Chodorkov was, as a student, was so excited by his ideas, he thought, wouldn't it be amazing to create at Goddard College an institute to create a wider audience for Murray's work? And so Murray actually had never had any role in playing an administrative role in the ISE, Institute for Social Ecology. Dan Chodorkov was always the director, and I've been part of it for 24 years, and we've always worked collectively. And Murray's actually had very little to do with the running of the Institute. But I can say for the people who are in the collective, the goals of the ISC were always to keep a loose enough definition of social ecology to make it dynamic, emergent, open, but also to maintain the rigor and the integrity of the ideas, to convey the ideas that Murray sought to teach in a way that was faithful to what his vision was about. And since 1996, which has been, I guess, 10 years now plus, Dan Chodorkov and myself took over teaching Murray's class when he was physically no longer able to do that. And the mission has always remained the same. It's been to promote social ecology not as a static body of ideas, but as, again, an open-ended, emergent set of inquiries about how to remake society along democratic, anti-authoritarian, and ecological lines.
What were Murray's political interests and affiliations towards the last years of his life?
It's very interesting. I mean, what always kind of amazed me about Murray as a friend and as a mentor is that, you know, at 85 years old, we were still having conversations up to a few weeks before he died about sort of what next. He, after being one of sort of the fathers of contemporary anarchism, he renounced anarchism about 6 years ago, maybe a little more than that, seeing that he felt ultimately that anarchism didn't really hold the kind of promise and potential that he saw it to have to really be a revolutionary movement. He saw people using it in the current movement more for the expression of personal and social projects, personal lifestyle projects. And he sought, again, a new, if you can imagine, you know, in your 80s, deciding, okay, I'm going to create a new theory and a new kind of analysis, and that's what he did. And he called this new theory communalism. And communalism means, most succinctly, the confederation of free cities, towns, and villages that are confederated together through a common constitution that is based on principles of ecology, direct democracy, social justice, and local economics, municipalized economics that's under the control of citizens. And he really, so his last sort of political writings are on communalism, and I encourage anyone listening to go to the social ecology website and read his wonderful essay. I think it's, I always get the title wrong, but I think it's called On Communalism, or actually it's called The Communalist Project, excuse me. And it's a wonderful essay where he really spells out some of the limitations of some of the movements that have been popping up before and after 9/11, and he suggests a different way to go. I mean, what was so exciting about him is that he was always ready to critique his own work. People a lot of the time are very eager to say, oh, he was critiquing this person's work or that person. He was hardest on himself. He spent the last several decades of his life really looking at the mistakes that he had made as a thinker in trying to re-navigate his way through the left. And he was, you know, literally a few days before his death, sitting in bed, still writing, trying to figure out not only what went wrong, but where do we go now? And I just have to say, I just love that about him. He was such a visionary man who had such a love for ideas and justice, and didn't just love ideas, but he worked for ideas as a speaker and a writer and a teacher and a mentor. And he gave so relentlessly of himself. Many people don't know that he lived his whole life, I won't say in poverty, but with a very modest, very, very modest material means. He he gave his all, literally, to the love of humanity and the love of freedom. And he gave his whole life to that project. I don't know one other person in my years on the planet who has devoted themselves so singularly towards a humanist project.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us about him today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I've been speaking with Haya Heller. Haya is an associate with the Institute for Social Ecology. She's a writer, a speaker, and activist in the feminist ecology movement, and she's the author of Ecology of Everyday Life, Rethinking the Desire for Nature, and she was a friend of Murray Bookchin's.